You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Virus headlines, Tim and I just covered a little bit of them. One thing that stuck out for me, Tim, medical experts who advise U.S. regulators on vaccines, they're really chafing at what they perceive as political interference by the Biden administration in the review process of booster shots. I have to say it's a little bit confusing for me.
It's confusing about booster shots and also confusing, okay, which are the vaccines or which is the vaccine that has been fully approved versus one that has emergency use authorization?
Right.
And what does that mean for employers who can mandate shots?
Exactly. I think it's really confusing. So let's get some clarity. Back with us is Dr. Peter Alperin. He is VP at the now publicly traded Doximity. You might recall it IPO'd back in late June. It is a professional medical network for physicians. He joins us on the phone from Austin, Texas, and he's been a great voice for us to reach out to during the pandemic. Dr. Alperin, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, it's good to have you back with Tim and myself. Tell us a little bit about, well, provide us some clarity is basically what I want, because it does feel like we're getting a lot of different information about the vaccine and boosters. How do you see it? What's the advice that you and your colleagues are giving out to patients?
Yeah, so I mean, the core advice remains the same, which is that we advise everybody, you know, for whom the vaccine is approved, which is basically everybody 12 and older, to go ahead and get their vaccines if they haven't done it. And we have seen an increase in the number of vaccines over the past several weeks, the number of people getting vaccinated. With respect to boosters, so at this current moment, the boosters, a third shot is to be clear, to clarify what it is we mean by booster, has been approved for people who have sort of certain immunocompromising conditions. And that can either be that they're patients who are living with cancer or that they're on medications which can suppress their immune system. But other than that, it is currently not recommended that people get a third shot. There is talk about on September 20th, that people can start to get their booster shots for people who got the shot very early, which is mostly people who work in healthcare.
The clock is ticking, though, to September 20th, and I'm wondering what kind of guidance you would like to see from the FDA or from regulators about who should get it, how long they should wait to get it. If they got Moderna, do they get a booster from Pfizer? Is that okay? If they got J&J and they got one shot, do they get two shots of the mRNA
there's
vaccines?
There's a lot of information out there.
What is going on?
Like the rest of us, it's very much a wait and see. I understand the frustration, but I do know that the folks at the CDC and the other federal regulatory agencies are working hard on this. I do suspect that what will happen is that people will be recommended to get a booster, likely of the same shot that they had before. And I have started to read things about suggestions that patients who received the J&J vaccine will receive another one as well. But you raise a very good point. You know, there's a lot of data out there that people need to sift through. One of the things that we've seen, certainly at Doximity, is just the explosion in medical information. And so providers are hungry for clarity like everybody else. But there is, in fairness, a tremendous amount of data. So, again, it remains the same thing. Be safe. Make sure that you're vaccinated the first time. But I suspect that these recommendations will come out quite soon.
Hey, Dr. Alpern, I got to ask about flu shots because here we are. I was at the pediatrician with my son earlier this week. The pediatrician said, hey, we got flu shots in. Do you want to get one for him? And I said, yes. And do you have any for me? And he said, we do. We have extra. And I got my flu shot already. What are you hearing right now about flu season? And what would you say to people who don't even have that on their radar at this point? Because we've been so focused on COVID. And last year was so mild when it came to flu season.
I just put it on my to-do list, no, flu shot.
Thank you, Carol.
Absolutely great question. And you're absolutely right that last year's flu season was mild, likely because people were really washing their hands and people were distancing. So important point.
Masks too, maybe?
Be spread. Pardon me?
Masks as well, maybe?
Yes, masks as well, absolutely. So a lot of the precautions that we were taking and continue to take in a lot of circumstances for COVID are very helpful to prevent the flu. And as I was going to say, is that flu is passed by touch much more than COVID, which has largely been shown to not be transmitted that way. In terms of getting a flu vaccine, it's absolutely a great idea. It's always a good idea to get your flu vaccine every year. The flu is a significant cause of morbidity and mortality, meaning that it puts people in the hospital and can even lead to death in those who are elderly or having certain compromising conditions. So I'm glad that you got your child the flu shot, and I'm glad that you got it yourself.
Hey, listen, just got about a minute left here. You guys have some new stuff that's going out. Tell us about your Residency Navigator tool, because you're a public company and our audience is interested in public companies.
Well, thank you for that. So one of the things that we do at Doximity is we have a variety of tools and features that help physicians at all stages of their career. And one of those features is the Residency Navigator, which is a tool that helps those younger physicians, the ones graduating medical school and choosing their training program, which is required of all doctors so that they can get licensed. It's a tool that we provide that helps them choose the program that's the best fit for them, depending upon what their career goals are. We update that with the latest data, and yes, that just got released a few weeks ago. So we're excited, and we're seeing great engagement.
Wait, and there's a couples match? 20 seconds. Is this like Tinder, the medical
there
version? Just
absolutely.
Quickly.
There's a tool that helps those physicians who have met their partner during residency or some prior time, who are both physicians, to be able to find a location that can support both of their career goals. And so if one is a surgeon and one is an internal medicine physician, they can both use this tool to find the best place to go.
It makes perfect sense. I have friends who, you know, had to fly every weekend to see one another when they were residents because they were residents thousands of miles away.
Is it like swipe left for a surgeon, swipe right for an intern?
I don't know. I'm not a doctor. Not on the platform.
Dr. Peter Alperin, always good to hear you. Your voice, Vice President Doximity on the phone from Austin.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, Hurricane Ida, not thank you. The fifth largest hurricane in our history. We heard President Biden saying that just about an hour or so ago, making its mark, Tim, from New Orleans and the Gulf Coast all the way up to the Northeast.
It's coming at the same time we're seeing extreme weather play out, not just throughout the United States, but throughout the world, with flooding in Europe and extreme weather in California and a drought that's just gripping the West.
All right, we want to talk about all of this because climate change, we know, is also impacting the frequency and ferocity of storms. Here with more on that is Bloomberg News sustainability editor Eric Roston, joining us now on the phone in New Jersey. Eric, first of all, I hope you and your family are safe.
Hi. Yeah. Thank you very much. We lucked out. A lot of people in northern New Jersey and in New York and the region had real serious flooding last night. And, our thoughts are with everybody who's suffering through this.
Yes, we as well. These storms, the type of storms, where they're hitting, what they're doing. Tell us, you guys cover sustainability, you cover climate change. How does climate change impact what we are living through right now when it comes to storms and weather patterns?
Climate change is exacerbating everything. It's making terrible things worse, basically. we've had, you know, projections for many years that are now really beginning to come true. Heat waves are hotter and longer and more frequent. Tropical cyclones like hurricanes in this hemisphere are becoming more intense. There's a very direct relationship between the temperature of the atmosphere and the amount of water vapor it can hold. Every degree the temperature rises, the air can hold about 7% more water vapor, and it comes down when conditions are right, as they have been for Hurricane Ida through the Gulf of Mexico up through the northeast, as we saw last night. So we've expected this. It is as terrible or worse mm-hmm. than we expected, and it leaves us with this very strange, situation, which is we're having these terrible weather events. And we know that greenhouse gases are driving a lot of the extra damages we're seeing. So that's where things stand today.
Eric, it's puzzling to me at the same time, because we're seeing these extreme weather events while we're also seeing companies come out, at least here in the United States and certainly in the European Union, with really ambitious climate goals. But these goals are years out. We're talking 2030, 2040, 2050. And I wonder how much worse things are going to get before they start to get better.
We have yet to turn the tide. Carbon dioxide emissions in the atmosphere, that's the most important greenhouse gas, continue to rise, even though they took a big hit, a really historic hit last year, down by like 5 or 6%. It's still negligible. So all of these pledges are super, super important. And I think in most cases, there's not reason to doubt the genuineness of the goals or the motivations to achieve them. But you're right. They have yet to become actualized in most cases. There is enormous progress in renewable energy, as we see just like year after year. The gains are phenomenal, even though they're still not fast enough. But this is an economy in transition that we have now. We see all the pressures. Yeah.
A global economy in transition. Just got 30 seconds. Just quickly, Eric. I mean, we talk about inequities. It does feel like those countries, those cities that are wealthier are going to be able to figure out solutions faster and better than others in terms of surviving climate change. Just quickly, is that fair?
That is totally fair. It was the subject of a feature we ran earlier this week that I draw everyone's attention to. Fortunately, and to leave on a hopeful note, many, many life-saving opportunities in heat waves and other events are not income dependent. We can save lives without mm-hmm. rebuilding cities from scratch.
Thank you so much for coming on. We really wanted to check in with you today. Eric Rosten, stay safe. Sustainability editor at Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone in New Jersey.
Important to check out that feature too, available at Bloomberg.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers, they're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, this week it is a special double issue of Bloomberg Business Week magazine. It's the city's issue, and the cover story of the issue is about Mark Lori, who, Tim, amassed a fortune-building e-commerce site, several of them, and he's on a new mission, investing that money into building a privately run city. He shared that vision with our own Joshua Brustein.
He did. And Joshua Brustein joins us now. He's technology editor at Bloomberg Business Week. He's joining us on the phone from New York City. I think a lot of listeners and readers of Bloomberg Business Week magazine might remember Lori from the cover that he was on a few years ago when he launched Jet.com. That was the way that the world found out about Jet.com before Walmart, a couple of years later, bought it for more than $3 billion. But Joshua, before we get into this, just give us some background about who Mark Lori is and really what he's trying to build after building these e-commerce sites.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for having me. As you said, Mark Lori has had a successful career building e-commerce websites. First, he built the company that ran diapers.com, which he sold to Amazon, worked for Amazon for a bit, left and built Jet.com, which was basically an Amazon competitor, which was bought by Walmart. He then ran Walmart's e-commerce division for about the last 5 years. But almost immediately upon getting to Walmart, he started talking to people about this plan to build a city from scratch, basically. His current plan is for it to have eventually about 5 million people. That would be 40 years from now, and obviously a lot would have to go right to get there. And he's just starting to lay some of the groundwork for what's a pretty audacious project.
Is it going to happen?
Historically, if you look at what other people who have had come up with similar plans like this, I think the answer would be no. There have been a really steady stream of these utopian city building projects over the years. I talked to a professor at McGill University who studies them and says that there's about 150 such projects underway right now. But she said she couldn't really point to a single one that had fully succeeded in its goals. Some of them do have some people, but they never quite get to the heights that they're aiming for.
Joshua, a few months ago, you got some time to really sit down with Mark Lori and really get his vision, which you lay out so clearly in the cover story of this edition of Bloomberg Business Week. What is it that motivates Mark Lori to do this? What is he concerned about? What is his thinking around this, the philosophy around this?
Yeah, interestingly, I sort of figured that, you know, a guy coming from the tech industry wants to start his own city, that mostly what he'd want to talk about are autonomous vehicles, drone delivery,
things like that.
I mean, sort of
light
touch
regulatory environment.
I think I want an ice cream cone in my hand and it just appears, things like that.
Exactly. And he did talk about that a little bit. But like the thing that he's really interested in is this model of land ownership, which was first floated by an economist named Henry George in the 1900s, which is basically the idea that you could hold all of the land in a city in a trust, and instead of allowing people to own their own land, everyone would be leasing the land from this central trust, and the income from those leases could be poured back into social services. And now Lori thinks that this is a way to deal with inequality, which he professes to be his main incentive in trying to pursue this project. It was a little bit jarring to hear this from a guy as he sat in his $44 million penthouse apartment and explained it to me. But that is really what he seemed laser focused on.
It sounds like a really nice apartment, by the way.
It was a great apartment.
Okay.
What I will say is, and we're getting ready to talk with David Rubenstein, who has a new book out called The American Experiment. And it's, you know, conversations he's had as America has continued to evolve and innovate and change on some really important issues. And I do think we are at this critical juncture when we look at some of our cities that are struggling and have struggled so much in the last year and a half. And you do wonder what happens going forward. Will the infrastructure ultimately come from the federal government and maybe change some of those cities that have been struggling? You know, do we have an opportunity because we could work from home? We don't have to work in major cities to reinvent the cities and towns that we have out there. So, you know, as crazy as it might be, Joshua, like you do wonder, does Mark Lori maybe have something that maybe there are ways we can do things better?
Yeah, I think that there's a couple of themes that come up in a number of these sort of technology-driven utopian city building ideas, which I think are rather valid critiques of the way that cities work now. I think Lori has correctly identified the fact that inequality is an enormous problem and is causing really a lot of strain on the capitalist system in the United States.
Right.
Also, if you have something like autonomous vehicles, you want to cut down on car use generally, these are big transformations of a city, and it's very hard to get things done in cities. They tend to really grind down due to inertia, politics. There's a lot of reasons why things can't happen. I think that those are good diagnoses of the problem. Whether you'd be able to do something like that by starting anew, I'm not sure that's any easier. It's certainly tempting to give it a try.
Where does this fall on his list of priorities? And also when he thinks about what he wants to be known for? I mean, this is a guy who's bought a stake in a pro basketball team, as you write. He's learning the basics of his new Steinway grand piano. He's got this team that's working on this new reality show. He's invested in eVTOLs. Where does this fall on his list of priorities right now?
I think the eVTOLs and the city kind of work. eVTOLs are electronic vertical takeoff and landing vehicles, basically flying cars. I think those might fit into the city. I think it's right to wonder, with all these other things going on, do you have this like sort of crazy project out there? If you're devoting, 20% of your time to it, like something that's basically impossible anyway, like can you do it in 20% of your time?
Yeah. Right.
That seems like a valid critique. His response to that critique, which obviously I raised with him, is that, well, starting now, there's not much to do with the city project, but over time it will become everything he does, and he'll sort of, you know, move towards devoting all of his time to it. I think it would have to get to a state much different than it is now to justify that, but that's his plan.
Well, there's so much detail in your story, and it's a great read. It is the cover story of the double issue of Bloomberg Business Week magazine on newsstands, on the Bloomberg and at businessweek.com. Joshua Brustein, thank you so much. Technology editor at Bloomberg Business Week. As we said, his cover story on Mark Lori trying to create a utopia.
Carol, I've interviewed Mark Lori a few times,
yeah,
before and during Jet. Just like a normal guy.
Normal's good.
Yeah. It's so interesting to hear about this grand vision.
Yeah, well, speaking of grand visions, David Rubenstein and his latest book, we'll get to that in just a moment.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, so grab your drink of choice, settle into a comfy chair. If you're driving, pull over, because we've got a great guest. Our next guest talks with all kinds of leaders from all walks of our lives, the household names, the execs, the innovators, the warriors, the upstarts, the artists. And from those conversations, he has written a trilogy of books, How to Lead on Leadership, The Second the American Story. It was all about the American history. And the book's title, The American Experiment, Dialogues on a Dream, is his third book in this series. So it's great to have joining us David Rubenstein. He is host of Bloomberg Wealth on Bloomberg TV and Bloomberg Radio. And of course, you know him as co-founder and co-chair of the private equity firm, The Carlyle Group. He joins us in our interactive broker studio. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's really wonderful. And I feel like you are someone who talks with so many different people, different points of view. We were wondering about the last couple of years with everything going on, how that kind of has shaped who you want to talk to and how you were thinking about this book, The American Experiment.
Well, generally, I like to talk to people who are willing to say something. As you know, from being an interviewer, If you watch the Sunday talk shows, sometimes you say, why do these people go on these shows? Because they don't really want to say anything. What you want is somebody who's willing to say something and say something they haven't said before. That's the best interview, right? And so I'm always looking for somebody who is willing to be engaging and doesn't want to just spar with the interviewer and not say anything. So, you know, it's a challenge, but that's what I'm trying to do. And you always want somebody that people will listen to and want to hear. So if I got an engaging guest, but nobody's ever heard of that person, it may not be as effective. If you can get Jeff Bezos, you know, that's what people want to hear from him. So,
right.
It's, you know, so you want somebody who has a name and who's willing to engage. And some people are great and some people are not as great. And, you know, you just figure it out during the interview.
But we think about what's happened with the pandemic, the Capitol riots, the inequities, George Floyd. We could go on and on. It feels like a decade or two decades of history have happened in the last year and a half. How has that, David, shaped kind of your thinking and putting this book together? And again, the voices you wanted to get to.
Well, each one has a different thing. Take the January 6th event. I do talk about it extensively in the book, and I basically say it was a severe stress test for America, and America won. And I dedicate the book to the public servants who protect our democracy, because remember, we had 65 lawsuits that were filed to overturn the election, and none of them actually prevailed. None of them got very far. All the judges basically complied with what is the rule of law, and they basically didn't act political. So I think we learned a lot about the importance of the rule of law in this country. We also learned a lot in terms of the importance of health care in this country, how it's so unfair that people of a minority status or are poor really were suffering disproportionately because of COVID, because they don't have good health care to begin with,
right,
and they didn't have access to the best health care. And it's a sad situation. But it also made me think about this, my mortality. I'm 72 years old, and when you're 72, you had a chance if you got this disease that you could maybe not survive. And we now know that 65% of the people who went on ventilators didn't actually come back out of the ventilators. We were putting people on ventilators thinking it was helping. It wasn't. So we learned a lot about how to treat people. But suppose I had gotten this and I went on a ventilator, I probably wouldn't be here now. So I learned a lot about my mortality and thinking about it. And the result is I'm rushing to get more things done because I now realize, hey, life is very short and something bad could happen very quickly. And so that's been something that I've been thinking a lot about.
It's like the Hamilton, right? I'm running out of time.
Right.
That whole concept.
Well, as you point out in the book, the American experiment has been relatively short at this point. And I'm wondering if you could contextualize the way that you think about what happened over the last year and a half as to what extent it really stress tested us. Because you do make note of the judiciary essentially saving the United States, not the lawmakers. Because you do call out in the book the lawmakers, the senators and the members of Congress who voted to overturn the election. They are still in power right now.
Yes, and I know many of them. And privately, they will say to you, well, I had to do that, or I knew it wasn't going to really prevail. Sure, but many of these people are, you know, I live in Washington. I host a series in front of members of Congress once a month. With COVID ending soon, hopefully I'll be resuming that. And I know a lot of members and so forth. And, you know, privately what they say is, well, I had to do this, and they didn't really believe in it, but, you know, and so forth. Some will say that. I'm not going to go say who said that. But clearly, it's a very political situation. It's just the saddest part of the whole situation we now face is that we've politicized the government so much so that the country's really unable to move forward very much. We have people who don't want to wear masks, who think that it's a good thing to force people not to wear masks, in effect. We you know, it's a sad situation in many ways when you think about it, that school children whose teachers want them to have masks are being told they aren't supposed to have that mask. So a bad situation, and people are dying because of this.
When did debate become like a bad thing? I thought that was what kind of the roots of democracy were all about, this whole idea of having different perspectives and hopefully talking it through and getting to a better place.
When I worked in Congress in the 1970s and in the White House, there were obviously political disputes all the time, and obviously this was after Watergate, but people thought eventually you got to get something done, and so you had bipartisan legislation. Now, if to be considered a great legislator, used to be you were good at bipartisan legislation, get people on both sides to work together. Now, to be a great legislator, you're probably somebody that is good in only getting your Democrats or your Republicans to support you. And members of Congress now spend so much time raising money because they want to raise money for their campaigns or to thwart anybody from challenging them. And they have to spend 40% of their time, in the case of members of the House, to raising money. And the money and the internet and social media has just divided the country in so many ways that I find it interesting when I host these dinners, many people say this is the most interesting thing that members feel they're doing in Washington. They can have a dinner when nobody sees they're meeting with somebody from the opposite party because there's no press there, and they can talk to people from the opposite house, which they rarely do because they rarely have conference committees anymore. It's, look, I also recognize this. Every generation, 10,000 years back and so forth, has always said, well, in my time, it was better, and now it's not as good. Now, George Washington's father allegedly told him, well, your generation is not going to achieve anything because you guys are not hardworking or whatever. Well, the truth is every generation tells the younger people you're not going to be tough enough, you're not going to be surviving enough, and ultimately civilization goes forward. So sure, there are challenges now. I'm not happy with many things that have happened. One thing that did happen, though, during all this period of time is the George Floyd murder. In that case, the thing that struck me was this. I lived through the Civil Rights Revolution. We've lived through the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, and so many things that have been done, affirmative action, other things. But this one murder crystallized for people in this country the fact that we are still discriminating in so many ways. Just think about it. All the people that have been lynched over the years didn't seem to have the same resonance as this one murder. Maybe because it was on TV, maybe everybody saw it, maybe because people saw it was so ridiculous the way it was handled. But we've made some progress, obviously, on racial relations. And I'd say in the book that while we've made a lot of progress on racial relations and gender equality and other things, we still have a long way to go. The rhetoric that is in the Declaration of Independence and the rhetoric in the Constitution is wonderful. Well, we've been spending 230 years trying to live up to that rhetoric. And to some extent, we've made progress, and to some extent, we haven't. And what I say in the book is that we have these genes. These genes are part of us, the belief in the rule of law, the belief in equality, the belief in the power of voting. And we've been trying to make sure that people kind of honor these things that are part of our genes, and sometimes we do and sometimes we don't. The rule of law is a gene that's so strong that it prevailed in the January 6th situation and the post-election fight, and I think that was good. In many other countries, had you had a leader do what was done here, I think you could have had a military takeover.
Yeah, it could have been much closer. I wonder, David, about this sense of optimism that you have potentially after writing a book like this. I do think there is this collective despair over the last 18, 19 months as this pandemic has played out and we try to get to the other side of it. And here we are sandwiched between extreme weather events, you know, that are affecting the entire country, whether it's drought or hurricane or fires, trying to get our kids back to school. After writing this book and speaking to these people and looking so closely at the history of the United States, are you optimistic?
I think most people who are asked that question will say yes, because nobody wants to say, no, I'm pessimistic. It sounds bad to say I'm pessimistic, and I'd be lying if I said I was pessimistic. It might make news to say I'm pessimistic. I am optimistic about many things. The young people are so creative. We are solving some problems like global climate change. We're working on some things. Racial relations are getting better. They're not perfect. But if you weren't optimistic, it'd be hard to get through life. If every day you were so depressed you couldn't get through life, you know, what would you do? So I'm optimistic, and I've had been fortunate in my life to be able to be optimistic because of good things that have happened to me. But generally, I'm reasonably optimistic. I'm just worried about some things that we could solve that we don't seem to be solving as quickly as I wish we would.
Let's talk about some of the conversations. Ken Burns, Madeleine Albright, Jill Lepore, who I don't know is necessarily a household name, Walter Isaacson, David McCullough, some of the things, Rita Moreno, some of the conversations that stood out. And obviously, they talked about very different topics.
The different topics.
But a common thread, I guess.
Well, Ken Burns talked about Vietnam, and it turns out in Vietnam, the political leaders knew all along. They knew all along that we had no chance of winning that war militarily. It was really a political exercise, which was disappointing because we lost 58,000 men and the Vietnamese lost millions of people. David McCullough did a wonderful job of explaining how nobody took the Wright brothers seriously in this country. They had to go to France to kind of prove that they could fly.
Another reason why we love France.
Right. You know, so Rita Moreno is an incredible story, a woman from Puerto Rico who was not taken that seriously as an actress because she was from Puerto Rico. She was given kind of Latina jobs, but she turned out to be an Academy Award winner, and she had an interesting life. She lived with a very famous person for quite some time, Marlon Brando, and I think 8 years or so, and then tried to commit suicide because he was unfaithful, and then she recovered from that and obviously went on to now win an Emmy, a Grammy, every other award, Tony, that you can win. So she's quite an impressive person now, still performing at age 88 or 89.
She was at our Boston Pops event, and she's a Spitfire. Got to meet her, and she's unbelievable in terms of her energy. You also talked with Walter Isaacson, and I think innovation is something we spend a lot of time here talking about around the table. And, you know, that governments, the complicated relationship, really, between governments and innovation, we're seeing it once again. What did you glean from that conversation?
Walter points out in his book, really a focus on the innovators, a book right before the Codebreakers. Codebreakers, a new book about a woman that won the Nobel Prize for, in effect, discovering CRISPR. And that's a great book as well. Mm-hmm. But the innovators is about all the people that have changed our lives, who invented the microprocessor, the transistor, the smartphone, the internet, all the things. How could we live today without the internet? How could we live today without smartphones, all these things? But now these all came about because of smart people doing things that people said couldn't be done, and typically as part of teams. There are very few geniuses that are discovering things by themselves. He points out usually it's a person working with somebody else, and usually they're building on something that somebody else actually did before them. But the most important thing is our country has been a country where we've been strong because of innovation. We are the country that innovates. We're reinventing ourselves all the time. Why aren't people in Europe inventing great companies like with companies we have? You don't see as much in Europe or in other parts of the world as we have been seeing here. Right now, the technology that's dominating the world, certainly outside of China, is American technology. Mm-hmm. Microsoft, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, all these companies are American companies. Why aren't we dominated by European technology companies or Middle East technology companies? Because Americans have this innovative style, and we really incent people to do things innovative here.
Wait, I got to follow. So what do you think about what's going on in China right now in terms of really clamping down, it feels like, on the innovators?
Well, in China, I think what's going on is the Chinese government is trying to make it clear to everybody that we, the government, are the most important thing and not the innovators. And so I think there's a concern that sometimes you get entrepreneurs who are worth a lot of money. They're cult figures themselves, Jack Ma and the equivalent, and they kind of rival the government leaders, and the government doesn't think that's appropriate. So the government is doing some things to constrain this. We'll see whether the impact is to have people not be quite as innovative, or whether people will try to take more money offshore, or entrepreneurs will come to this country and not go back to China. You don't know yet.
Will it prevent, though, China? And we're talking, of course, with David Rubenstein. His new book is The American Experiment, also host of Bloomberg Wealth here at Bloomberg Radio and TV, and co-chair, co-founder of the Carlyle Group. But it's interesting, David. Do you think it'll prevent China from being kind of a global presence when it comes to innovative technologies, which is what President Xi has said he wants to be?
It may have some impact. But right now, for example, what is up in the air is who is going to dominate technology around the world over the next 10, 20, 30 years? Is it going to be the American technology companies, or is it going to be the Chinese? Right now, the Chinese technology companies have largely been successful in China. Google and Facebook really don't quite operate in China. They have their own equivalent there. But has China been able to take Alipay, Ant Financial, or Alibaba outside of China that much? Not so much. Or the same with Baidu. Now, the only one that's really become a major force outside of China is ByteDance, which has TikTok, but it doesn't operate at all in China. It really operates outside. But over the next 20 or 30 years or so, there'll be an effort by the Chinese to say, let's take our technology companies and use them in Europe, Latin America, the Middle East. And who will dominate? Will we have two internets, or will we just have one internet? And it's unclear. To the extent that we weaken our technology companies in this country, it may be that we won't be dominant around the world as much as we have been. But when you think about it, you go anywhere in the world now, you can use Google, you can use Facebook. You can't go use Baidu or Alipay anywhere in the world. That may change.
Unless you're in a part of China where one of those services is blocked. David, given what's happened in China over the last few months, would you be hesitant to deploy capital there, to invest there, at least for the near future?
I am an investor in China. I've been a long-term investor there. My firm is an investor there. I personally invested there.
But what about thinking forward over the next few years, given what's happened over the last few months?
There clearly are going to be some constraints on growth and valuation. So, for example, many of the companies that have had some constraints, the Ant Financial transaction is one in where the valuations come down because they're not going to go public quite as quickly as they were going to. I still think, though, you've got a population of 1.3 billion people and a gigantic market, the biggest market in the world. And the country is becoming increasingly wealthy, and therefore people are increasingly spending money. We operate a number of companies there. We operate with our Chinese partners at McDonald's in China. And clearly that's a growing business, doing well. So I wouldn't be hesitant to invest in China. I just be hesitant to do things that the government isn't going to really like. You got to be very careful and make sure you know what the government will tolerate and not.
The book at the very beginning, you include the preamble to the Constitution. If you could sit down with a forefather today, who would it be? And what would you want to know?
Well, I will answer that in 1 second. I would just say that, interestingly, we had white Christian property owners, men, who were our founding fathers, right? If we had a new Constitution or Declaration of Independence, who would those people be? Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be all white men, right, or property. We'd have, presumably, women. We'd have minorities. It'd be, would we get a different Constitution? Would we get a different Declaration of Independence? Probably would. If I could have dinner with any one of those founding fathers, I guess it would be Thomas Jefferson, just because his rhetoric, his writing style is so wonderful. And I'd ask him, how come you never made a speech? As president, he only made one public speech. If you ask Walter Isaacson, he would say he'd like to have, of all the people he's written about, he'd like to have dinner, I think he would say, with Benjamin Franklin, because he's so creative and so brilliant in so many ways, uneducated by traditional standards. But now, any of them, I think if I could have dinner with anybody that's ever lived, who's an American, not currently alive, it would be without doubt Abraham Lincoln. In my view, the greatest American of them all, kept the Union together, freed the slaves, though not as quickly as some people would want it. But he was an incredible person, writer, great speaker, and I just like to ask him this, a lot of questions. And it's an interesting phenomenon. You and I are all in the interview business. And this is a business where it's just relatively common now. It's not unique to be an interviewer, right? Lots of people, right. You know, everybody has a podcast. I think there should be a bumper sticker that says, honk if you don't have a podcast. Everybody's got their own podcast. Everybody's got their own TV show. Everybody's got their own radio show. But this is relatively new. For most of organized history, there were no interviews. So we have no interviews of Shakespeare. We have no interviews of Cleopatra. We have no interviews of Abraham Lincoln, George Washington. I wish we could go back and interview them. I thought about doing a book interviewing what these people would have said if I'd interviewed them.
That's a great idea.
So I got to say to William Shakespeare, no, Will, why do you think it is that people think you didn't write these plays? Or did you really write these plays? Tell us the truth. Or Cleopatra, who was a better lover, Mark Antony or Julius Caesar?
When you land these interviews, let us
or
know.
Both.
We'll
right.
Clips.
Yeah. Or Henry VIII. Why didn't you just get a prenup instead of chopping off the head of your wives? There's a lot of great questions we want to know the answers to.
Well, that's book number four.
Yeah. Right. You did get some fantastic names for this book, you know, including Ken Burns, as we talked about, Madeleine Albright, John Meacham, Billie Jean King. Who did you reach out to that you couldn't get?
Who said, I'm sorry, who's this David Rubenstein? I don't have time. Kidding.
No, look, some people do not like to do interviews, and some people are more complicated to get a hold of, and so forth. So I... on this particular book, I have not interviewed, let's put it this way, I have not yet interviewed Elon Musk. I'd like to do that. Walter Isaacson is writing a book about him, and that presumably will be the source of a lot of information.
We saw that on Twitter a few weeks ago, Elon Musk talking about that.
I talked to Walter about it, and he's very happy. He's spending time with him now, and Elon is, I won't give away all the stories.
But it is happening.
It's going to happen, absolutely. And I would say that I'd like to interview, I haven't interviewed Mark Zuckerberg. I'm on a board with him in China. I've been there, went and talked to him a couple of times, but I haven't really interviewed him. I think that'd be interesting. I had a chance to invest in that company when my son-in-law-to-be was at Harvard, he said, you invest in this company. I said, it's a dating service, and dating service never get anywhere. That was $13 billion ago.
Ouch. But, is there a woman that you haven't talked to that you would like to talk to?
Well, Queen Elizabeth doesn't do interviews, so I think that's probably not going to happen. But I would say I have not interviewed Mrs. Obama. Mm-hmm. I've met her many times. I haven't interviewed her. She'd be very good as an interviewee. I have interviewed Melinda Gates. I've interviewed many business leaders who are prominent women. And
Mackenzie Scott, have you thought about?
I have met her, but I don't have an interview. I haven't actually asked her yet. I think she's relatively shy.
Okay.
And doesn't seek publicity as the way she's doing
it.
If she's watching or listening right now, I'm ready to come out to Seattle tomorrow and do that interview. Because she's doing some really good things in philanthropy.
And really turning the world upside down by doing it fast, doing it very differently than how a lot of other people have done it for a long time.
Yes, and I mean, she's got, I think she was given $34 billion, and now it's probably worth $75 billion. So she's got a lot of money.
Yeah. We have 3 minutes left. Please don't go anywhere. No, just stay forever. The investment environment, I don't know, whether it's SPACs, whether it's crypto, what's interesting to you right now?
Well, clearly crypto is something that gets a lot of attention. It's amazing how many people are interested in crypto related.
Are you invested
things.
In crypto in any way?
I have not invested in cryptocurrencies myself. I have invested in some companies that kind of service the industry. And my standard view on crypto is when you go to Las Vegas Most people are smart enough to know you're not going to win there. And if you spend more time there, you're certainly not going to win, but you enjoy it. You have the pleasure of gambling. So you pick 1% or 2% of your net worth and do that. Well, the same is true in crypto. Crypto, you want to speculate. You don't really know that much about it. Try it 1% or 2% or 3%. It's not harmful, and you'll probably have an enjoyable time, perhaps. I interviewed for my show on Bloomberg John Paulson recently, mm-hmm. and he is dead set against it. He just said, this is terrible, and it's going to zero. But on the other hand, I've interviewed some other people that will come out soon who are going to be saying, hey, I think it's a way to make a lot of money. There's one person I'll be interviewing soon who's made billions of dollars in crypto.
Mm-hmm. What about when it comes to SPACs and where we are in this cycle with SPACs?
SPACs.
Are they here to stay? And look, SPACs aren't anything new.
No.
They're just having a moment right now.
SPACs are not going away, but you have to be wary of what you're doing. You have to know what you're really doing. So SPACs are a way to accelerate an IPO process. And right now, it's harder to raise money for SPACs. And not just the SPAC money. There are two types of money you have to really raise. You raise the initial money for the SPAC, but then you raise money that's called a pre-IPO pipe money, which is the money to help you get public or help the public evaluation stay to what you think it should be. And it's harder to raise that money right now. A lot of somebody is raising, I think it's Apollo, is raising a fund to invest in the SPACs that aren't doing so well and to buy them on the cheap, which is an idea that I think is probably has some merit.
We've already gone to distressed SPACs. 30 seconds left here. What do you think will be the next grand American experiment? Just quickly.
Well, the next experiment that I think we'll see, I think probably we're going to see at some point, I hope, greater cooperation between the Republicans and Democratic parties when we have some crisis that really unites them in ways that we haven't really truly been united since 9/11. Now, we're getting ready to celebrate the 20th anniversary of 9/11. We're going to do that at the Kennedy Center. I'm the chairman of the Kennedy Center. We're going to have an event doing that and thanking our military people, but also thanking the healthcare workers who got us through this most recent period of time.
We thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much. David Rubenstein, of course, co-founder, co-chair of the Carlyle Group. His latest book, The American Experiment, Dialogues on a Dream. Do check it out. It's a great still summer. It is still summer, everyone. Still summer read. This is Bloomberg Radio.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers, they're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/GreenFestival.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive home.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive,
just drive,
baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, yeah, just about 11 and a half minutes to go until we wrap up the Thursday trading day. Definitely wrapping around, Charlie noting that we are well off our highs of the session, Tim.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I should turn my microphone on. How's that?
It's been a crazy day. Maybe, with us, everyone.
Maybe the producers are trying to send me a signal.
No.
Stenevec, you're talking too much.
We want you.
Well, let's get to the drive to the close. Aaron Gannon is co-founder and CEO of Clear Harbor Asset Management, with assets under management of more than $1 billion. He joins us once again on the phone from Stamford, Connecticut. Aaron, great to have you back on the show. How are you doing?
Doing just fine.
Hey, help us make sense of...
Carol are doing well.
Yeah, we are doing
well.
We're
hanging in there.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. It's been a challenging 24 hours in the tri-state area, certainly, for many of our friends and colleagues. We're thinking of them. Aaron, I want you to take us into today's trade ahead of the jobs report. It does seem like investors are kind of stepping back and certainly looking to what happens tomorrow. What are you looking for?
Well, you know, clearly, there's a big question around the trajectory of employment, but I also think that we've just gone through a very strong earnings season. We've had the majority of companies experiencing robust top and bottom line growth, and markets are sort of at all-time highs, at least the S&P 500, that is. And so I think there's some indigestion, clearly, in the market, but there's also sort of a forward-looking process that everyone is undertaking right now, not only as it pertains to the data tomorrow, which is important and could weigh on the Fed's thinking in September, but as it pertains to growth. And our expectation is that growth is going to continue to decelerate from very lofty levels, and that the bond market has, you know, really sniffed this out many months ago, back starting in March when yields peaked. And I think there's a concern that as growth decelerates, so goes the market. But I'd also push a little bit back on that sort of prevailing view. Our thought is that we've already seen a significant rotation within the equity market out of sort of that pro-cyclical move that we started to see back in mid-June and play itself out when oil peaked to a more growth posture going into the non-farm payrolls on Friday.
You know, what's interesting is I like what you said about indigestion in the market, because it does certainly feel that way. At the same time, the world is awash in liquidity. And our Gina Martin Adams comes on consistently and says that money's got to go somewhere. And you increasingly see it, or continually see it, go into the U.S. equity market because, again, the U.S. economy has certainly bounced back first, if you compare it to the rest of the developed markets. And that's where investors seem to be continuing to place the bets. And I guess right now we have to figure out how long that kind of trade also continues.
Right. Yeah. And I think as growth does decelerate, that trend towards growth equities and perhaps more defensive segments of the equity market, like healthcare, could still accrue to the U.S. market, perhaps more than the international developed markets. If you just look at the sort of constituencies of those markets, we have more tech than, for example, the Eurozone. And so if that trend prevails, it could just sort of accrue to the U.S. marketplace. But I also think that sometimes not making a big bet on cyclical versus growth is not a bad idea from time to time, and this may be that moment. You know, we've already had this sort of front half of 2021, massive cyclical move higher, oil, industrials, materials, banks, all outperforming the technology sector, for example, consumer discretionary and communications. And in the last 2.5 months, we've seen the opposite play out. And the back half of this year, I think, may be one where we continue to see that trend, but it will not be as robust as just the last couple of months.
But that's to be expected, too, to be fair. I mean, Morgan Stanley kind of came out with some expectations talking about a U.S. slowdown in the third quarter. I mean, that is to be expected compared to, right, because the dynamic, crazy numbers of growth have happened as we bounce back from the pandemic. And I'm sorry, Tim, for cutting you off.
No, go ahead.
But I mean, right, that, I mean, it's kind of playing out like we expected in many ways.
Yeah, but if we were talking a month ago, Q3 growth was probably a 1% percentage point higher than it is right now on expectations.
Okay.
And so they've come down even further. And the question is, will we continue to see a ratcheting down in growth expectations? I suspect we could. We saw the ISM data, disappoint. We're seeing growth slow in China, both sort of export-driven growth as well as consumer-driven growth. In fact, there is a belief that the central bank wouldn't be moving to sort of shore up their currency, and And now there's a belief that the central bank will be, you know, much more, you know, incrementally dovish. So that has huge implications for global currencies as well as equity markets.
How are you deploying capital right now? How are you putting money to work from clients?
Good question. Every one of our clients has a different sort of risk profile, a different objective, different duration as well, depending on whether or not they're a non-for-profit organization or an elderly couple or a young professional. And so we really take all of that into account in trying to sort of structure portfolios. And so equities, Tim, tend to be at the sort of core of a portfolio, but we also believe in the idea of allocating for particular clients that, you know, are averse to having portfolio volatility to the extreme, allocating to anti-fragile assets or assets that can sometimes buttress a portfolio when the economy and the equity markets are not performing well. So that could, depending on the moment in time, include gold. It could include components of the fixed income market, like longer duration or short duration treasuries, as well as investment grade credit, mortgages. So our view is that treasuries still have a role in a multi-asset class portfolio, even though they are unfortunately yielding a negative level at the moment. So, for example, tomorrow's non-farm payrolls report comes in and it's at 200,000. We're not so sure the equity market behaves all that well tomorrow under that scenario.
Why?
That would be so weak.
That is 725 is the 725,000 is the estimate from according to Bloomberg.
Right. So if it was an extraordinarily weak number, it could, you know, this is how counterintuitive the market is today, though. But in theory, there could be some market indigestion there. But on the other hand, we could see the long-dated segment of the treasury market rally. Mm-hmm. And that could also afford the Fed to be even more dovish. So then, you know, we could see equities, in fact, rally on the heels of extraordinarily weak economic data.
Right.
So it's just an interesting time to be an asset allocator.
Well,
it's
that movie we saw for a long time, I feel like, Aaron, after the financial crisis. Bad news was good news. It meant the Fed was going to stay easy for longer. And so, you know, I always think about this with the economic news. At some point, we want the economy to get back to normal. Normal is good. But the investment markets don't always see it that way.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, we do see opportunities within equities across multiple sectors, but, you know, whether it's artificial intelligence or the renewable sector of the economy, water utilities still look extraordinarily interesting to us. You know, they're just, you know, still wonderful companies in the midst of a market that's trading at 20 times forward multiple and doesn't look exceedingly attractive, that are continuing to grow at 30-40% you know, revenue growth on an annualized basis. And the question, of course, comes down to price.
All right, we got to run. Hey, Aaron, have a good holiday weekend. Aaron Kennan, co-founder, CEO of Clear Harbor Asset Management, over $1 billion in assets under management, on the phone from Stamford, Connecticut.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.